Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the recent White House summit to counter violent extremism and Obama's efforts to bridge the growing divide between the West and Islam that has been met with derision from the Republican right, who are demanding that Obama hold the Muslim religion itself responsible for the actions of terrorists, rather than, as the president tried to make clear, quoting Obama, "We are not at war with Islam, but at war with those who pervert Islam." Following an outburst from former New York City Mayor Giuliani, who seems to think the president is so soft on terrorists that he does not love America, we will look into the bizarre symbiosis between the forces that are radicalizing Islam and the reactionaries in the West who want to declare a religious war. Joining us is Annie Zonneveld, who is the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values, whose group was among the Muslim reformists who were not invited to the White House summit that was dominated by conservative American Muslim groups. She will discuss her open letter to the new king of Saudi Arabia at Al Jazeera, open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. Saudi Arabia should curb Wahhabi ideology to alleviate human suffering in the Muslim world, and her efforts to reform a religion that has been captured by Saudi Arabia's Wahhabi ideology, which Annie Zonneveld argues is at the root of all the ills in the Muslim world. Then we will speak with Robert Scheer, a journalist, author, and editor-in-chief of Truthdig, about his new book just out, They Know Everything About You, How Data Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. We will discuss this double jeopardy facing American citizens of corporate and government spying, and the recent White House summit in Silicon Valley, which called for a private and public sector partnership to combat cybercrime and cyberterrorism, which was boycotted by the heads of Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Facebook, whose overseas businesses have been severely impacted by Edward Snowden's revelations that the NSA was intercepting and collecting data stored by giant American tech companies. And joining me now in the studio is Annie Zonneveld, who is a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an open letter to the new king of Saudi Arabia at Al Jazeera, open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. Saudi Arabia should curb Wahhabi ideology to alleviate human suffering in the Muslim world. Welcome to Background Briefing, Annie Zonneveld.
Thank you for having me, Ian.
And you get right to the heart of the matter, basically saying that Saudi Arabia started exporting the Wahhabi ideology in the 1970s, and it has spread around the world, turning existing interpretations of Islam into one that is dogmatic and violent. Have you heard back from the king?
No, I haven't, and I don't expect to either.
So, but since it's been published by Al Jazeera, presumably it's been noticed.
Yes, it has been, and I think, if anything, what I hope to get from this letter is a groundswell of like-minded Muslims that come together and to raise this issue of theology, this intolerance that we've been, we've been bombarded with in the last few decades, and to raise the awareness for non-Muslims as well. But for Muslims in particular, it's important for us to create that change from within.
And when you say Saudi Arabia's Wahhabi ideology is the root of all ills in the Muslim world, that's fighting words as far as Al Sauds are concerned, right?
Yeah, I agree. And that is the intent, because when you have all these murders and beheadings that's happening in ISIL, and it's supposedly a deviant teaching or a deviant understanding of Islam, well, there's not much difference between ISIL's theology and that of Saudi Arabia. And and the root of it is from Wahhabism, that intolerance. There is this Sunni supremacy that comes with that theology that is just like Nazism, and so it makes it easier for you to justify your human rights abuses and these pushing LGBTs off tall buildings. It's despicable.
Well, clearly, with ISIL or Daesh, I think is a better way to put it. And they don't like being called Daesh, do they?
Can we call it Daesh on this radio show, if you don't mind?
Yeah. Right. We won't say what it means, though. So, I mean, what they're doing, though, is because they're pretending or claiming to be the new caliphate, they clearly will be pushing the Saudis in the opposite direction to the one that you want them to go. Because it would seem to me that if the custodians of the holy shrines are being, the legitimacy is being questioned by this upstart group, this so-called Islamic State, that's going to have the effect of not moderating the Saudis, but making them even more conservative because, after all, you know, the same flag, just a different color.
That's right. Yeah, they created the monster, and the monster has come back for them. So then the question is, what do we in the Muslim community, how do we change the reaction of the Saudis? How do we temper that? What's really unfortunate is that our U.S. government has actually empowered them even more, the Saudi government even more. For example, last week we had the CV, the Counter Violent Extremism Summit. Funny, but just about everybody in the room there were all conservative Muslims and not really the grassroots organizers that have their pulse of the Muslim community on the ground. And what the government has decided to do is to set up a partnership with the UAE and conduct and help the UAE create a counter-narrative, radical, counter-Islamic radical narrative from there. When in actuality, what we should be doing is we should be supporting the grassroots efforts within the Muslim community, and there's plenty of them. And that is the, I think, is the better way to go, is you empower those Muslim voices that are, have already created animated counter-radical narrative in Somali, in English, in America, in Pakistan, in Egypt, and wherever. And not the money not going to the governments, but going to the people that have been fighting this battle, because they're the one that's been on the receiving end, right? The governments have been the oppressors.
Well, let's go back to what was Mecca and Medina like before the Wahhabis took over? Because my understanding is that it was extremely pluralistic and a tremendous wide spectrum of Islamic thought, most of which was on the more liberal progressive side.
That's right.
Even to this day, there's still resistance to the Wahhabis in Mecca and Medina.
Yeah. At an inception, Islam is, that's our understanding, Muslims for Progressive Values, we believe Islam is inherently progressive. And the expression of religion, how religiosity was expressed, it was not defined and moderated. Like now, you have to pray five times a day because the government tells you. There's no such thing during that those time during Prophet Muhammad's days. And there, people converted in out of Islam at a drop of a hat. It wasn't, nobody got, there was no such thing as Sharia law even. There is no such thing as Sharia law. So the fact that we have this draconian, unethical, and unjust religious law called Sharia law, it is completely a man-made construct, and that has happened throughout the centuries. And it's been a man-made construct because it is the political systems of the day that that incorporated pre-Islamic law, their interpretation of what's in the Quran, plus the social norms of the day, and they meshed it up together and they called it Islamic law. And then they have, of course, the clergy whom they pay to officiate that as religious, right? So, but I'm originally from Malaysia. Every time I go back to Malaysia every few years, the Sharia law court changes its rulings on divorce. And my argument is, if it's really God's law, how did that change? You know, so there is Mecca, Medina, especially during Prophet Muhammad's time, has always been much more open and much more egalitarian in its expression. It is really the true essence of what Islam is. But it died with his death, as far as I'm concerned. Islam died with his burial.
Again, I'm speaking with Annie Sonnenfeld, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an open letter to the new king of Saudi Arabia at Al Jazeera. Open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. Saudi Arabia should curb Wahhabi ideology to alleviate human suffering in the Muslim world. So is there a symbiosis then between conservative reactionary Wahhabi Islam, which has been spread around the world. And we know what the compact the Al Sauds have is that they get to take all the money. There's no democracy. It's all trickle down. They have absolute power, but they use the religion and the Wahhabi clerics as a way to political control, because they're so draconian in their social outlook that people are constantly preoccupied with whether their, you know, hair is showing underneath the hijab, or, you know, they can't drive, they can't do anything, the women in particular. So that seems to be the nature of it. But on the Western side, and particularly now with this very toxic attacks on Obama and the Democrats from the Republicans, many of whom are running for president, they're basically, I mean, they hate him in a way that's beyond comprehension. It would seem, though, that, as we mentioned earlier, under pressure from the so-called Islamic State, it's likely that Saudi Arabia will become more reactionary and less progressive in order to maintain their legitimacy, because their legitimacy is being attacked by people to their right. Mm-hmm. So that's going to push them to the right, not to the left.
Yeah.
And it would seem the same thing is happening here in this country, where you have conservatives in this country telling Obama that he's ducking the real issue in their minds, which is the conflation of Islam and terrorism. Their argument being that Islam is inherently violent.
Well, they are wrong, obviously, but I think the problem with when it's very hard to actually have an honest conversation about this, when on one hand you have Muslims in America that their mantra is Islam is a religion of peace, and when the reality is not so. On the other hand, if you are going to say, if you're going to paint Islam and Muslims all as terrorists, then that's also a false start. That is really counterproductive to what you want. Now, what it depends. If you what you want is war, then yes, that would be the Republican way, would be the way. But if you want allies in order to fight in this ideology, then you have to, I think the way Obama is approaching is probably the most wise way. But I still have some issues within that frame, and that is not acknowledging and this I think is directed more to the Muslim community in heads and organizations in the United States, that when you see in the recruiting magazines of Daesh and Al-Qaeda, and every page is filled with religious language, we have to ask ourselves, why is that? Why is there religious language? And why is this religious language appealing? Is it a dog whistle? Why is it familiar? It's familiar because it's part of this Wahhabi doctrine. It's familiar because it's probably taught in schools. Now, yes, I am acknowledging there is a mental health issues, there's disenfranchisement and so on and so forth. But in part of this big pie of what makes someone radical, one portion of it is religion, and I'm addressing the religion part. And that is something that the Muslim community has not addressed straight up and honestly. You cannot beat around the bush and say Islam is religion of peace and this has nothing to do with Islam. They even say that. Well, that's not true.
Well, it's not working, is it?
No, it's not. And the only way to make it work is to really, it's like being an alcoholic and then completely denying you have an alcoholic problem. You're not going to be able to get to cure yourself of this addiction. And that's where we're at.
So, and this is where you come in.
I hope so. Well, I think so.
But no, so let's posit a counter narrative here. Because in your piece at Al Jazeera, open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz, you talk about your own childhood in Malaysia, and you talk about how, for example, you celebrated the Prophet's birthday, and that was a party, that was a celebration. The Wahhabi brand of Islam emphasizes his death and martyrdom and all of that stuff.
Yeah.
And that community events featured music and dance. The sexes weren't segregated. You know, this is a
cultural shift.
It is. And
yes.
and that's obviously the way it's been imposed, is that they've become a cultural fetish, yeah, as opposed to a religion that's, you know, I mean, religion's not supposed to oppress, it's supposed to emancipate,
isn't
it?
That's right, that's right. And this cultural shift is not just in Malaysia, it's in Africa, it's in the United States. I mean, one of the reasons why I felt the need to create Muslims for Progressive Values was I put an Islamic pop CD, and none of the Muslim websites in the United States would sell it because I was a female singer. And but we've always had centuries of female singers in our tradition. And so why is this all of a sudden issue here in America? And this is the interpretation of Wahhabism here in America.
Well, is there, though, something at a very basic level in terms of the oppression of women? And it seems to be, without getting into pop psychology, there seems to be a fear of women's sexuality.
Yeah, there is. And it's very strange. It's as if women don't have sexual desires. It's okay for male band, male vocal groups, and all the girls go crazy.
Right.
And in their hijabs, but it's not so.
Right. But the idea is that if women are not modest, in other words, if they're not veiled, men are simply incapable of controlling themselves. And therefore, the whole rationale is to protect women's virtues.
That's really lame, because if you say that to the men in the progressive Muslim community, they would feel very offended because they are beyond that.
Well, it presumes that most men are sex maniacs, right?
Yeah. So in our community, we women lead prayer in a co-congregation, right. Men praying behind them. And we have no sexual issues whatsoever. Right. And sometimes men lead prayer and we pray beside each other. We pray Mecca style because we don't segregate in Mecca. Mm-hmm. So why do we segregate in the mosques?
So the more you tell us about the differences, the more you realize the extraordinarily malignant influence of the Saudis.
That's
how
right.
They've taken this religion away from its core values and made it about something else.
Yeah, that's right. It's made it into a very dark culture rather than, like you say, a faith tradition that that emancipates you. I mean, when I read the Quran after 9/11, and I really surrendered myself to this process, I said, okay, I don't know what these guys are about, so I have to relearn Islam for myself. I surrendered to the process and said, if I leave Islam, so be it, and if I become more Muslim or more closer to the faith, then so be it. And I found the Quran to be incredibly liberating. And it is, faith is supposed to free you from the box that religion puts you in, right? And Islam is one of those faiths that lifts you up from that box, because you are really, there is a saying in the hadith which is written, compiled 100 years after he died, and it says that, and he apparently said, to know yourself is to know God. And that is, in essence, that's what it's about.
So obviously there's some extraordinarily violent passages in the Bible, particularly in the Old Testament, and much of fundamentalist Christianity in this country is Old Testament, the Beatitudes and the idea that the prophet Jesus, ministered to the poor. The vision you have of Christianity in the Christian fundamentalist televangelist style here in the United States is that, so far from the idea that Jesus Christ didn't hate homosexuals, didn't encourage people to have assault rifles, to give money to televangelists, etc. So in the spirit of he who is without sin casts the first stone, obviously there is, a similar challenge that you have and that you've taken up. And what's your sense then of how to raise your profile? Because, as I say, every day the people are trying to conflate here in the West Islam with violence. And there are obviously, if you read, just as if you read the Bible, there are some outrageous passages. And if you read the Quran, I'm sure they're equally so. Mm-hmm. So how do you address those selective quotes that people use to suggest Islam is a religion of violence?
Yeah. A lot of the violence is actually in the Hadith, not in the Quran. And the Quran passages where it says, swipe them, the non-believers, this is specific, specifically during a particular war that was happening and in that particular context. Because after that, the language is inclusive. The language is, if they make peace with you, then you lay down your arms. You live in peace because God prefers peace. But it's funny, they prefer, they don't quote those passages, but they quote they pick and choose. But we can pick and choose too. We can pick and choose the loving and compassionate interpretation of Islam. And we are just as valid in that sense as the radicals are. And so then the argument should be, why should we even teach those radical passages? Why should we not then teach it in a way emphasizing the context and the historical story behind it, not just some abstract passage from the Quran that anyone can pull out? Why do we even entertain these hadiths that contradict the Quran? And that's actually where a lot of the problem lies, is in these hadiths. I think that what I find very amusing is when the emails that we get from non-Muslims that quote the radical passages and then accuse us of being not Muslim enough, and because they want to perpetuate this violent Islam and that it's not possible for a Muslim to be peace-loving and rational. Right, so that's the other fight that's happening underneath it. But it's an educational process, and we believe that the only way forward is for the Muslim population themselves to be re-educated about Islam, because we've been indoctrinated for 40 years with this Wahhabi indoctrination, where that has become Islam.
So where would one turn to then? To rectify and to rediscover the pluralistic, compassionate, and loving version of Islam?
We have a lot of reading materials on our website, mpvusa.org, but we are also holding a conference next year in Paris. It's a coalition of Muslims who are trying to counter this radical shift. It's a bit late, but it's better late than never. And we are having a progressive international conference in Istanbul in 2016, and it's called the Alliance of Inclusive Muslims.
Let's just take a brief station break, and we'll be back and continuing the conversation with Anis Sonnenfeld. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, and we're continuing the conversation with Annie Sonnenfeld, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an open letter to the new king of Saudi Arabia at Al Jazeera, open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. Saudi Arabia should curb Wahhabi ideology to alleviate human suffering in the Muslim world. But in terms of scholars and scholarship, who do you turn to? Because one of the things that is so obvious that's happening in the Islamic world is the extent to which progressives and liberals are the first target of the Wahhabi radicals.
That's right.
The Sufis in particular. They've in Pakistan, they've completely been driven out of the Swat Valley.
That's right.
So, we know that, and on television, on Al Jazeera and on Al Arabiya, it's always these conservative guys ranting, carrying on. Yeah. But you don't really see too many people that can say, wait a minute, this is all nonsense. You guys have got it all wrong, and this is why.
Yeah.
Who is your theological mentor, if you will?
We prefer to go to turn to the scholars like Khalid Abou Fadl, Anaïm Abdullah out of Emory University, Dr. Amina Wadud. She's a feminist Muslim scholar. There are a lot of feminist scholars in the United States and in the West. There are a few as well in the Middle East, but some of them have been house arrest and killed off. So we don't necessarily look at imams. We don't look at the theologians. We look at the professors and the scholars of some, because they tend to be more honest and they tend to be more non-biased, let's say. So those are the books and those are the theological basis from which we advocate our positions. They're very progressive positions. And I think it's because of that 7+ years since our establishment, we are still standing. None of these imams have been able to knock us off, to delegitimize us, because of the scholarship background that we have and the support we get from them.
Well, you know, you've also got the the original text, right?
Yeah, that too.
It's the same with the same argument in Christianity. Yes. You know, where is the Christian left? We know about the Christian right. And the problem there is that for some reason or other, the Christian left actually has the New Testament totally on its side.
Yeah.
But they can't break through they're getting drowned out by the reactionary narrative. So, I mean, there's obviously a comparison or an analogy there, sure.
Yeah. I think the left, the spiritual left, have to borrow from the religious right in their strategies, and that is to dumb it down and to be very blunt in the messaging and almost borderline intolerant. So you shouldn't be tolerant of intolerance. And that's something that we've learned from the Tea Party. I think we just have to be very blunt in our messaging and no holds barred. So that's why I wrote this letter too. I'm done. I'm sick of it.
Right. So in terms of taking on the Islamic State or Daesh, the so-called Islamic State, you know, they are very slick at propaganda. Some of it is unbelievable, the brutality, but nevertheless, it's well produced. Is there a way to use media? I mean, I don't know how many millions the United States government's spent on setting up its Arab language networks, none of which anybody watched. You know, it's like the broadcast to Cuba that nobody watches, you know.
See, that's the problem, is we talk about media. There are progressive Muslim voices are not getting heard enough in American mainstream media. And
Have you been on Fox?
No. No, I've been Fox, CNN, neither MS, none of those shows.
Uh-huh.
So the perception of Americans, for example, is that you have the radical Muslims, which is always in the news, and you barely get any alternative counter-narrative to that. And if you do get the counter-narrative that you get the conservative institutions, Muslim institutions in America, Islam is a religion of peace, right, group. But you're not getting my voice and other voices that have been speaking up against this shift in Islam for many, many years. And we've been saying this for the last 7-8 years. So when you turn on the news and day in and day out, all you hear is radical Islam and Boko Haram, and 30, 40 Shias have been killed while during prayers, girls and children shot up in the name of Islam. It's hard not to believe that Islam is a violent religion. But it's unfortunate that the media also censors out progressive Muslim voices. So, for example, we've been interviewed many times, especially after 9/11. It was the 10th year anniversary, and our local television show did a special on it. And the progressive Muslim community came about as a direct result of 9/11. And yet, when it was all done, it was only the conservative Muslim voices that were heard. I mean, if you wear a hijab, then you're Muslim enough, right? Mm-hmm. And if you don't, you're not. And if you espouse a certain set of positions that are outside of the traditional conservative stance, then you're not Muslim enough. So the media itself perpetuates this thinking among the American public. So I don't blame the American public for its lack of knowledge of Muslims like such as myself and others. I do blame the media for picking and choosing what gets aired. I've met so many editors, so many instances where the editors edit us out, not the reporters, because by that time you've built a relationship with the reporters, right? Mm. And the researchers, but it's the editors that edit you out.
Well, but that, again, shows you how far we've drifted in terms of being captured by stereotypes and prejudices. The fact that you're not wearing a hijab somehow makes you not a Muslim, as opposed to the fact that you choose not to wear a hijab. Where does this all come from, though? Is that ever in any of the
sacred texts?
The sacred texts? The idea hijab. that women have to be sort of cloistered?
No. The only time that hijab is mentioned in the Quran is in reference to a wall partition. So if you wanted to talk to the prophets, well, you have to talk to them through a wall partition because of some personal incidences that happened. The only other time where the Quran dictates about being modest, it dictates it to both men and women. And the only time that the Quran mentions about covering is to cover your bosom. That means to cover your breasts. Mm-hmm. Because women in some tribes they were bare-chested. We mm-hmm. know that. Mm-hmm. That's historically, anthropologically documented. So that's what the Quran dictates, to cover your chest. Mm-hmm. It's not to cover your hair. It's not to cover your skin. It's not to cover your voice, your opinion. Mm-hmm. You know, the Prophet's first wife was a businesswoman. She was older than he was. She proposed to him. So why is it in Saudi Arabia and many of the Muslim countries, 14-year-old girls are married off to 54-year-old men against their own will, when the Quran says that marriage is between two consenting adults? 14-year-old is not an adult. So there's so many contradictions between what the Quran teaches and what the reality is.
But the point I was making was that, in effect, the fact that you don't wear a hijab means you don't fit into the stereotype. Therefore, they're not interested in talking to
you.
That's
right.
That's the crazy part of
it.
And I take it that there are millions of people, and women in particular, who feel the way that you do. I believe, and I've talked to some Saudi dissidents, that festering beneath the surface in Saudi Arabia is kind of a revolutionary fervor, that the young people there are just so fed up.
Yeah.
They can't date, they can't do anything, and they're texting and carrying on under the surface. It's just roiling under the surface.
Yeah. So in Saudi Arabia, there's several activists that are in jail and that we've been advocating for their release. One is Raif Badawi, who's that blogger. So we've been advocating for his release since December of 2013. And now there's, with the help of so many other advocates and his wife, who's now based out of Canada, she's been an incredible advocate for his release. And that's become sort of the blogger who's been flogged, that's been sort of the catchphrase. His lawyer, who's a human rights lawyer, he's also in jail, and so on. And the only thing that Raif really did wrong was establishing with another human rights lawyer a website called Liberal Saudi, and it was basically advocating for rethinking of Islam, politics, and it was done in a thoughtful and thinking way online, and that's why he's in prison for 10 years.
So do you think then that there will be some kind of social explosion at some point? Obviously, the Arab Spring shook up all these despots, and we know that the Saudis
clamped down.
They've essentially funding the counter-revolution in Egypt, and they've also, in many ways, created the Islamic State as a way to discredit the Arab Spring, and clearly that's blown up in their face. Now, you had this huge delegation of Americans showing up. Everybody that was anybody in the national security field shows up there and kneels before the king. Is there, you think, any chance of the U.S. asserting itself, or do they just go along with the narrative in the same way that conservative imams in this country go along with the narrative?
They will go along with the narrative because that is the easier path. I do not hope for Saudi Arabia to erupt in a revolution because it's going to get really ugly. I really hope that's why I wrote the letter, because I feel that the peaceful path would be for the king to make those changes and to do it openly in a manner of good governance and to do it in a way that is just system for all. That is the only way to bring along the Saudi society and other Arabs and other Muslim society at large onto a path of democratic systems, but not just democratic, but just good governance, no corruption. And that's really at the root of all these revolutions and at the root of all this upheaval.
But just in closing, the excuse given by so-called moderates and reformers in Saudi Arabia, and after all, the last king was called a reformer, and they keep referring to these kings as reformers, and reform never happens. And the excuse being that they can't push it too far. If they let women drive, the clerics would be up in arms. Don't they control the clerics?
Well, that's what we think, but, you know, there is the... I think it's just a lame excuse. If they can have such control over the economy and the flow of money and how they've benefited from it, then I don't see why they can't pay the clergy to shut up.
Hi, you and a bunch of your friends, right?
That's right.
That would be a lot better. Well, I thank you so much for joining us here in the studio today. Annie Sonnenfeld.
You're welcome, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Annie Sonnenfeld, who's a singer, songwriter, producer, activist, and the founder and president of Muslims for Progressive Values. She has an open letter to the new king of Saudi Arabia at Al Jazeera. Open letter to Saudi King Salman bin Abdulaziz. Saudi Arabia should curb Wahhabi ideology to alleviate human suffering in the Muslim world. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back joined in the studio by Bob Shear. And joining us now in the studio is Robert Shear, a journalist, author, and columnist, a senior lecturer at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communications, and editor-in-chief of Truthdig, which he also founded. His books include The Five Biggest Lies Bush Told Us About Iraq, The Pornography of Power, How Defense Hawks Hijacked 9/11 and Weakened America, The Great American Stick-Up, How Reagan Republicans and Clinton Democrats Enriched Wall Street While Mugging Main Street, and his latest book just out is They Know Everything About You, How Data Collection Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Shear.
Great to be here.
And you have discovered the unholy, not the unholy trinity, it's the fusion of Orwell and Huxley. And this is the dystopian world that we are now in. And we're getting it, we have double jeopardy. Corporate America spies on us, and the American government spies on us. So what are we to do?
Well, the, you know, positive story here is that there are some real contradictions. As Leonard Cohen says in one of his songs, there's a crack in everything, and that's how the light gets through. Until Edward Snowden came along, and I do think Edward Snowden is the you know, one of the really great heroes of modern American history. I'm amazed at how he's kept his act together and how clear he is. But what he turned over let us in on something that really we chose to ignore, many people, for opportunistic reasons or convenience or what have you. And as long as we were not paying attention to it, and what I'm referring to is basically the alliance between, as the subtitle of my book says, the corporate snoopers and the government agencies, we were able to indulge the fiction that we were turning over all of our information as an extension of consumerism. This was a notion of consumer sovereignty trumping all other notions of freedom. And as long as we thought this was in something called the private sector, and, you know, and everybody knows it now, if they have an iPhone or the latest one, you give your thumbprint. This is a dictator's wet dream, you know, everyone, 20, 30 times a day, you're giving your fingerprint to a corporation. And they're through that fingerprint and everything else you do, they can see how far you read into a book and what you ate for dinner and who you had dinner with, what movie you went to, everything else about you. And that data is then mined by third parties that it's sold to. And so that's the basic model of the internet. It's the basic source of profit. There is the reason that the internet has been able to put the LA Times, New York Times, and everybody else out of business is because they can do something traditional commercial broadcasting and print journalism couldn't do, which is they could track you. And they could destroy your privacy, and then they could do these targeted advertisements to everyone. And so this total invasion of privacy by these private corporations was welcomed by people because they thought it would make them better shoppers. It was a better way of doing consumer sovereignty. And as long as people know that that's what's going on and they know where their data is going, okay, then you say that's a bargain you make with the devil. But what Snowden revealed is you didn't know where your data was going. And in fact, even these big internet corporations claim they didn't know where the data was going. I think there's some fiction there. But, you know, they claim they didn't know the extent of it. Google, Facebook, and Apple, and all of them claim to be shocked. It's like the scene in Casablanca, you know. So what happens is that this data we now know is made available to the government, and not just this government, by the way. Eric Schmidt, the former CEO of Google, wrote a book in which he very clearly laid out this can be done by third-rate dictators around the world. It's once you accept the idea that they can tap into these information conduits, these highway of the internet and everywhere, they can get this data, or they can get it from third-party marketeers. They can buy it, and so what it does is it allows any government in the world to have a power over its citizens that totalitarian leaders could never imagine, and it goes beyond anything that Orwell or Huxley could imagine. And so there's two basic problems with this. One is it destroys political democracy, the idea of representative government. And the reason for that is, and the reason we have the First Amendment, the Fourth Amendment, other limitations on government is because individual sovereignty, the integrity of the individual experience, the right to read in your own home, your own mind, whatever books, to associate, to go over half-baked ideas, radical ideas, or what have you, find all sorts of inspiration for thought, analyze your human condition without the government intruding and observing, was the basic thing protected by the founders, by the framers of the Constitution. So privacy, even though the word is not mentioned, the concept of individual sovereignty going back to English common law, challenges to the king, really is what the fight was about in the American Revolution, that the agents of the king could not come in with general warrants and search your home and get your possessions. So that's one big contradiction. It's an assault on the very notion of representative government that's enshrined in our Constitution. And secondly, it represents a very profound threat to the profit-making business model of the internet companies. Because if people, and it's not just here, our companies are trying, multinational companies, trying to appeal to consumers in Europe, which has pushed back, in China, where Google is just about excluded, or India, anywhere, Brazil, where you tapped into the phone of your leader, or Germany, where you tapped into the phone of your elected leader. And so if you want to present as a multinational corporation that can serve the consumers around the world, you can't be beholden to your own national security state, whichever one it is. People will not trust you. And so until Snowden revealed all this, it was sort of working out. Other people were revealing it, but not really with this kind of power, the number of documents, the extent of it. And once that cat is out of the bag, it put tremendous pressure on these internet companies who are pushing back in a very dramatic way. I mean, I wake up in the morning and I have an alert from Google, of all places, not just from the Electronic Frontier Foundation and other good organizations protecting consumers, but from Google, from Facebook, from Apple. Alarms. We have to get the Senate to rein in the NSA. I mean, that's pretty amazing development. Sure. And it's there because of a contradiction. This government will be putting them out of business if this process is not in a very profound way tamed.
Well, the recent White House summit in Silicon Valley at Stanford University, which called for a private-public sector partnership, the heads of Google, Microsoft, Yahoo, and Facebook boycotted it. The head of Apple did speak before the president and made a very strong plea for privacy. But when you talk about a devil's bargain that we have in terms of corporate data mining, we are monetized. You and I are monetized, Bob, but we get nothing out of it. That's the part that I find extraordinary, is that the monetization of the individual has reached, and it is, as you point out, it's basically the currency that keeps the internet going.
Right, but that would be fine if we were aware of it, if we had knowledge, and we make that deal. The reason that the internet companies have been critical of the Obama White House is that Obama with Podesta, who's now Hillary Clinton's main advisor, try to pull a fast one. And they said, yeah, these government agencies like NSA are doing that, but they're trying to keep us safe. The real enemy is out there is these private companies. Now, there's a truth to it. The data is basically collected by private companies, because if government were caught doing it, we'd all be offended. If government demanded, imagine if the FBI said, we want everyone's thumbprint, and we want that thumbprint connected with every purchase they make. You know, people would say, wow, this is the Gestapo. What kind of FBI is this? Okay. So, however, if they can get that data by tapping into Google or Apple or Facebook's information base and get that, then it seems, well, the government's not doing anything. And so what these private sector companies are pushing back on is they say, you're using us, but it will come out. It does come out. It has come out. And it's destroying our business model. And I think it's an important point to understand. It's one thing to say, you know, and I'm certainly no great friend of multinational corporations, but, you know, at the end of the day, if they are truly private and it's really a consumer transaction, and then it's your choice. If it's, you know, it should be the role of government to protect the consumer, to make sure it's transparent, that we know where this data is. So you should have opt-in as opposed to opt-out. If they're going to sell your data, AT&T or Facebook or anyone else is going to sell your data to someone else, it's your data. You should be informed and you should have to opt-in. You should say, I give permission to do that. Okay. That much we should have a right to demand and should demand. But if it truly is in something called a private sector, those people at AT&T and Facebook, they don't have the power to break down your door. They don't have the power to arrest you. They don't have the power to hound you in all of the ways that the FBI, the CIA, and everybody. There is a distinction between government agencies anywhere in the world and if they are truly private agencies. It's the marriage of the two here that is so frightening. And what the pushback from Google and Apple and Facebook and all these people is about is they say, you're lumping us with what you want to do. And what you want to do is truly ominous. It is. So it's one thing to say, I want to manipulate you. Oh, you Yelped this thing and you went to this. I'm going to suggest a restaurant that's even better around the corner. I'm going to suggest this movie. I'm going to target you with an automobile. I'm going to do this. That's what they're doing brilliantly. Now, you can object to it. You can join Consumer Reports or Union. You can push back for consumer rights. It's a different thing than your police force. Look, right here in Los Angeles, there's a company called Palantir that was started by or financed by originally for its first 3 years in part by the CIA. Palantir, okay, a Silicon Valley company. They mine the data for all of our leading intelligence agencies. They also have a contract with the Los Angeles Police Department. They have all this data that they can take from the LAPD, combine it with their FBI, CIA data, right? It's a privately held company. All right? And what control do we have over them? What do we know about what they're doing? So it's the marriage of the public and private, which principled libertarians, not all libertarians are principled, but principled libertarians of the kind that hang out at the Electronic Frontier Foundation and others.
And Justin Amash in the Congress, who led the vote to NSA data mining, which came very close.
Yes. And
he's
still
a Republican, by the way.
Yes. No. I mean, I think unfortunately, the left has been asleep on some of these issues, and this is not a left-right dispute. It's a question about people who respect a basic tenet of our Constitution, which is the sovereign right of the individual, and that the state is granted power. The state does not grant us power. And when the state has power, it's a power that should be challenged, questioned, corralled, and so forth. And that's the fundamental idea of representative democracy in this society, and it's being thrown away. Look what Robert Reich, who knew the Clinton administration, says in the back of my book. He says that Robert Scheer reminds us that privacy is everything, the protector of our liberty, the guarantee of our personal autonomy, the fountainhead of our democracy. And yet it's disappearing faster than an electronic blip moving at warp speed from your computer to the NSA. That's the ballgame here. And it can be reversed. And as I say, there are some real contradictions because, you know, we live in the age of the multinational corporations. Another book I wrote a long time ago, America After Nixon, The Age of the Multinationals. But you can't be a truly marketing multinational corporation if you're under the thumb of your own nation's national security agencies. It's a contradiction. People will not trust you.
And again, I'm speaking with Robert Scheer, a journalist, author, and columnist, a senior lecturer at the University of Southern California.
By the way, I'm a professor there.
You're a professor.
I'm a clinical professor. I have that rank.
You've been
rank.
Promoted. Oh, well. Do you have tenure?
No.
He is now a professor at the University of Southern California's Annenberg School of Communication and editor-in-chief of Truthdig, which he also founded. His latest book just out is They Know Everything About You, How Data-Collecting Corporations and Snooping Government Agencies Are Destroying Democracy. So we had sort of some hints that this was on the way with Admiral Poindexter's total information awareness, the fact that the now head of the FBI, James Comey, who was acting attorney general at the bedside of the attorney general Ashcroft, who was about to be operated on, and Andy Card, and Gonzalez came over and tried to get him to sign off on a continuing program which to this day we don't know about, but what we do know is that the head of the FBI and the acting attorney general were prepared to quit unless they stopped this program. And apparently when George W. Bush found out about it, it was only a week or so before the election, he was running against John Kerry, and he was alarmed at the extent to which there would have been a Saturday night massacre. The entire Justice Department would have walked out. But what I find interesting, Bob, is we don't even know what that regime was that these guys refused to sign off on the continuation of.
Well, the Total Awareness program which actually started before 9/11, but with 9/11, it got licensed to go crazy. You know, here we've had, I mean, whatever you think about it, 9/11 is not the worst attack that any nation has experienced, okay? I've spent my whole life traveling around the world, interviewing politicians, seeing what's going on. There isn't a dictator anywhere in the world who can't say, hey, my country was attacked. We suffered this. I don't care who they are, you know? They do it on religious basis. They do it on political basis. We look at our history, you know, and every country's got these grievances. Then they make this argument that the only way we're going to be safe and secure is by challenging your freedom. Well, the assumption of our Constitution is quite the opposite. The assumption of our Constitution is that freedom is not a luxury you have when you're never threatened. Freedom is something that makes you stronger. Good ideas drive out bad ideas. Freedom prevents you from committing errors. You know, freedom prevents you from destroying your own people, right? It holds you accountable. And that whole idea got chucked after 9/11. Somehow, all of the restraints on government came to be seen as a luxury we could no longer afford, you know? And as a result, we went into a war in Iraq. Why? Because we did not have freedom to explore the arguments being made for going into that war. We were intimidated, you know? And what the whistleblowers, these, you know, brave but terribly few people, I mean, Daniel Ellsberg said he waited 40 years for another, you know, someone like himself to come along. But we know they're punished. We know this administration, the Obama administration, has punished them more severely than all of their predecessors in terms of use of the Espionage Act. We know that people who consider themselves liberal and claim they believe in human freedom are quite willing to sacrifice our freedoms in the name of making us more secure. What I try to show in the book is, in fact, that argument is bogus. When Obama tried to come up with one single example of getting this haystack of all of the information that we all have all over the world to find some needles, you know, of the bad guys, it turned out he had one example, and it was a fraud. It was the example, I'm sure you're quite familiar with, of the hijackers in San Diego, who it turns out were living in a house of a guy who was an FBI informant. The CIA knew all about him.
And rent was being paid by the Saudi ambassador's wife.
Exactly. And also they said we had to have all this haste that was so we would know that they called Yemen. Garbage. AT&T had the power and the right and would have given them that information of what calls were made from that house to a house in Yemen. They didn't have to grab everyone else's data. So the thing is a fraud. They have not come up with one single example where they made the country safer. You take the most cases like the Boston bombing, take the attack on Charlie Hebdo. Okay? The people who did that, or allegedly did that, were people known. In the case of Charlie Hebdo, one had already served time. All you needed was old-fashioned police work. You go, hey, where is he now? What are they up to? What are they doing? You didn't need to collect the data on everyone in France or everyone in Boston. It's a garbage argument, you know. And the fact of the matter is we've gone off to these wars. Take ISIS as an example. You know, where did ISIS come from? It comes from an opposition in Syria that we supported. It's the same thing as Al-Qaeda in Afghanistan.
Funded by the Saudis, created by Sultan, the defense minister.
Exactly. So the point is that it makes us weaker not having this information. It makes us weaker when we're intimidated. We go off and fight wars that make no sense. We fight them in ways that make no sense. I mean, all my life I have dealt with this. I ain't, you know, a kid anymore. But I remember, you know, I was in Vietnam in 64 and 65 writing about this. I believed that at least the Gulf of Tonkin attack, the second attack, had happened. It wasn't until 20 years later we got the document that showed it was an absolute fraud. The whole reason for expanding that war was a total fraud.
This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.